Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill Karofsky presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Good afternoon. Please have a seat, everybody. Yeah, what happened? I realized that this case was scheduled for 11 a.m. and our first argument went a little long, and we probably messed up several other schedules for today. So I apologize for that, but I'm glad that you are here with us today. We are here in the case of Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Gary Thompson. Can I start with the appearances, please? Afternoon.
Yes.
That's the case, man.
Gary Thompson, go full here.
Thank you. Thank you. And what I have is 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, whenever you're ready.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, and may it please the court. As my co-counsel indicated, I'm Stacey Rosenzweig. I'm here with my colleague, Kathleen Williams, as well as attorney Gary Thompson, who I have the honor of arguing on behalf of today. This case is about interpretation of an unclear rule and what should happen to a lawyer if they interpret the rule in a way with which the OLR, or the, for that matter, the court disagrees. Particularly given the burden of proof here. The OLR has the burden of proof to show by clear, convincing, satisfactory evidence that an attorney has committed misconduct. The attorney does not have the burden of proof to show otherwise. Attorney Thompson is accused here of violating SCR 20.3.4B, and excuse me, I don't articulate the colon, but there is a colon in there. The rule simply states, relevant here, that a lawyer shall not offer an inducement to a witness that is prohibited by law. It does not state the converse, that they only may offer an inducement that is expressly permitted by law. The problem faced by Attorney Thompson, and for that matter, members of the bar at large, is that while Wisconsin has some clarification as to what is expressly permitted, for instance, the out-of-pocket expenses a fact witness has in getting to testify, and the value of their time, there isn't a lot of clarification beyond that as to what that means or what is permitted, what is prohibited. 23.4B, by its text, comments, and opinions, simply doesn't provide sufficient guidance for lawyers to understand what's permitted and what is not. A US Supreme Court case, Gentile versus State Bar of Nevada, 501 US 30, 1030, tells us that courts should not enforce vague rules against lawyers who attempt in good faith to comply with them. And that's what happened here and what brings us here today. I don't want to belabor the facts too much because for the most part, we're not disputing the facts. Attorney Thompson does dispute the finding in paragraph 12 of the finding of facts that Mr. Trojan's employment ended in August 23rd, at least as he, or August 2018, at least as he understood it. But we don't need to, we can talk about that a little bit later. Some brief background may be helpful to understand why this rule, at least in this situation, is vague and why and how Attorney Thompson attempted to, and I think did succeed in complying with it nonetheless. Here, Attorney Thompson represented his client's Skyrise Construction in a matter related to the rehabilitation of a historic apartment project. There was a primary contractor, Catalyst Construction, CatCon, and Skyrise had employed a project manager. His name was John Trojan. He had a 2017 employment agreement, which is Trial Exhibit 6. And when CatCon unlawfully terminated the subcontract that Skyrise was a party to, Mr. Trojan and everybody else were kicked off the site. Mr. Trojan was deprived of his salary and the potential for a completion bonus. Now, neither Mr. Trojan nor Skyrise, by its owner Ignacio Garcia, actually wrote to each other as the 2017 agreement provided and said, we're done. They There's testimony that Mr. Trojan never said he quit and never got fired in writing or otherwise. That's testimony from Mr. Garcia. So the matter between Skyrise and CatCon was put in suit and then referred to arbitration. Attorney Thompson was to help Skyrise prepare and present its case. One thing immediately stood out to Attorney Thompson. There was a lot of stuff to go over. The sheer volume of files. A photo of his portion of the files, at least some of it, was included in trial exhibits at 503. He was expecting to get more information, perhaps emails, blueprints, whatever it was from Discovery and CatCon, perhaps double what he already had. This was going to be an enormous undertaking. Attorney Thompson and Mr. Garcia decided that Mr. Trojan, as the project manager, would be the best person to help piece this together. Now, Mr. Garcia also knew the file well. He was the owner of the construction company. And that business had been disrupted by the breach of the contract by CatCon. So Attorney Thompson was to reach out to Mr. Trojan and help, and he was also instructed he can be offered some compensation for his time. Attorney Thompson did not go into this blindly. He reviewed the 2017 agreement and determined, based on his review of the Phillips versus U.S. Bank case, his understanding of employment law, some searching he did, that Mr. Trojan, but for CatCon's breach of the agreement, would have been entitled to his salary as well as a completion bonus. He was aware of the ethical rules and, you know, again, had looked at them. He understood that a witness couldn't be paid for the contents of their testimony, but they can be paid for the reasonable value of their time. Whether they were employed or unemployed, they could be they could be given lost wages or some other equivalent of the value of their time. And here that time was going to be substantial. Mr. Garcia also testified that he wanted to make Mr. Trojan whole, that Mr. Trojan had suffered from this breach that they were suing or going into arbitration over. So he conveyed to Mr. Thompson the idea of paying that bonus, that completion bonus of up to $25,000, which was roughly, as told to Mr. Thompson, the amount that corresponded to what the completion bonus could have been under the contract. $25,000 is just an easier number than a number with a bunch of decimals and stuff. So it was made some sense for conversation. Attorney Thompson then, again, at his client's request, reached out to Mr. Trojan. At first, they estimated that $2,000 was reasonable for the amount of time it was going to take to get this done. It was going to take a couple weeks. And later, that was raised to $5,000, in part based on Mr. Garcia's research, finding that the going rate for a construction manager had increased considerably since the 2017 contract. This was in 2001, after the beginnings of COVID, when in-person blue-collar jobs were commanding significant bonuses and were just hard to staff. Mr. Garcia testified that he had conducted a study of what the ongoing market rate was, and he'd reached out to a staffing agency to try to figure this out. And so Attorney Thompson reached out with this in mind across between August and October of 2021. They did have a phone conversation, and after that, there were some messages from Mr. Thompson. Mr. Trojan, we know now, wasn't particularly receptive to this discussion, but he never told Attorney Thompson no. He didn't respond to the text messages. Attorney Thompson didn't interpret these as an unwillingness to help and kept trying. So in summary, as he understood things, he was conveying an offer he was legally allowed to convey on behalf of his client who had done research, as did he, in essence, to get a displaced employee back to help out with preparation for an arbitration and possibly testify and be made whole if they were successful. Unfortunately, unbeknownst to Attorney Thompson, during the interim, Mr. Trojan and Mr. Garcia had a falling out. There was a dispute over taking a pay cut. There was an unemployment dispute. And in 2019, Mr. Trojan wrote a disparaging affidavit about CatCon that he, about Skyrise that he provided to CatCon's attorneys, but did not provide to Mr. Garcia or Mr. Thompson. They only learned of this after the offers were conveyed. So that brings us again to why we're here today. The issues here, I think we can take these separately, are whether the offer of the $2,000 to $5,000 for Mr. Trojan's time, and then separately, whether that $25,000 completion bonus would have that Mr. Trojan would have been entitled to had CatCon not breached the contract and had the contract otherwise been fulfilled, Were these unlawful inducements prohibited by SCR 20.3.4b? We have asserted a void for vagueness argument, and we can get to that. But I do think some context as to why these were proper in the first place may be helpful. And I invite the court to look at this from either or both alternatives. Attorney Thompson concluded that these were not prohibited and therefore were permitted. OLR and the referee ultimately determined otherwise. The problem here, though, is that Wisconsin really lacks guidance as to who may be correct. So let's take a look at those initial offers of payment first. What sort of guidance do we have? We have the plain language of the rule, which simply states you can't offer a prohibited inducement. But beyond that, we've got two ethics opinions, formal opinions 8809 and 8917, which read together stand for the idea that a non-expert witness, so a fact witness, may be compensated for the fair value of their time, including lost wages, the wages they would have earned if they were not in a conference room going through documents or sitting in a courtroom testifying. 8917 clarified that for unemployed people, whether it's retired or otherwise, they may be compensated the reasonable value of their time. That opinion declined to opine as to exactly what that meant. It said, we're not going to reach whether this means the wages that they would earn in a job if they were working or that they earned in their past job. It just says that's going to be determined case by case. So here, Mr. Garcia's market research showed that $90,000 a year, the equivalent of a couple thousand a week, was the fair value of Mr. Trojan's services in the 2021 market. So that roughs out to just a couple, 2 to 3 weeks of work, frankly. If Mr. Trojan had been continuously employed by Skyrise, say they finished the CatCon contract, got breached, he got pulled off, but there was somewhere else that they could put him right away. So he was on another project. And Mr. Garcia and Attorney Thompson decided to pull him off the project for a couple weeks so he could sit in a conference room going through stuff for the Skyrise arbitration. I don't think anybody would be arguing that he couldn't be paid his salary. Regular wage and hour law require that, in fact. There's nothing that we could locate that suggests that re-engaging a former employee or perhaps an employee who'd just been displaced but was still subject to a contract under either scenario, that would be any different. Perhaps the Centennial Management Services Inc. case out of the District of Kansas may be helpful here. That case involved another former employee of a party that was paid up to $70,000 in payments for document review.
Counsel, can I just ask? It seems to me that what you're arguing in part requires us to draw different inferences from the facts than the referee did, and to credit Mr. Thompson's motivations differently than as seen by the referee. And those are fact questions. So can you just respond to that, please?
Well, I think the evidence is fairly, is you know, Mr. Thompson testified that he had intended to convey these offers for Mr. Trojan's time. That's the text message, the text messages attached to the, that are included in the appendix. Just say, we will offer you $2,000. And there was later offer of $5,000 that I don't think we have the documentation for in the record, but I don't think that's under dispute either. There's the idea that this is for your time. There's a lot of stuff to go over.
And it's really not disputed that the offer was made in exchange for Mr. Trojan testifying and providing some other assistance in that arbitration, not for compensating him for the work he already did as project manager.
Well, the $2,000 to $5,000 was intended to compensate him for his time. The $25,000, and this is why we're looking at them separately, I think, the $25,000 was intended to, because if the contract with CatCon had not been breached in the first place, the CatCon to Skyrise contract, then Mr., at least as Attorney Thompson understood it, and there is some later information that things had sort of fallen apart, so well after the fact, well after these offers were made, it may have been clear to Attorney Thompson that perhaps Mr. Trojan would not have actually been entitled to this money because of other problems. But as far as he was concerned, had CatCon not breached the subcontract, that Mr. Trojan would have been entitled to that completion bonus.
But what he was offering to Mr. Trojan was contingent on Mr. Trojan's cooperation in the arbitration, wasn't it?
The offer, as it's written in the text message, says, should we prevail, you'd be entitled to $25,000. It doesn't say, should you show up and testify and say things that we like, or should you testify at all? There was anticipation that he would testify. We're not denying that.
And the referee construed those communications as being an inducement for his testimony, in essence, correct?
I mean, they were, and there is evidence that they were supposed to induce him to cooperate in various fashions, including testimony if it got to that point and if it was necessary.
And again, so why, how is it that you're asking us to construe those facts differently?
Well, the question here is this an inducement prohibited by law? You're not allowed to pay for the contents of testimony, but there is no guidance whatsoever that you're not allowed to pay somebody for stuff that they were owed back in, you know, back in.
There are two possible inferences to be drawn from the evidence presented to the referee. You offered one possible interpretation. The OLR offered a different interpretation. And it looks to me that the referee thought that the evidence was more compellingly in support of the OLRs. That's a determination that the referee is in a better position to make than we are.
We understand that factual findings won't be disturbed unless they're clearly erroneous. And I don't think we can find, there is evidence on both sides. We can't find those clearly erroneous. So then we need to take a look at whether this is an unlawful inducement. Again, SCR 20.3.4B prohibits unlawful inducements. And there is just simply not Wisconsin case law suggesting that paying somebody, again, there is a nexus here between that $25,000 and what Mr. Trojan's relationship with this transaction was.
With respect to that nexus, the $25,000 was should they prevail at the arbitration hearing. That's not like we've just are going to pay you for your testimony. That's if we win, we'll give you $25,000.
Well, if the contract hadn't been breached in the first place, then from Mr. Thompson's perspective, then Mr. Trojan would have been owed a completion bonus of around that amount. That's where that was.
But weren't you talking about it wasn't completed? If it's a completion bonus, we know the project wasn't completed because isn't that why you're having the hearing in the first place to talk about the non-completed? So I don't understand your
right. It's kind of a, I guess, a breach of contract by proxy. I don't know that that's not a legal, I'm not using that as a legal term of art or anything, but.
But he was only being paid the $25,000. Well, he was being paid it with anticipation. He was going to testify and only if the matter resolved successfully, correct?
Right. And you know, to be clear, and this was indicated in our briefing, Attorney Thompson believes he intended to say up to $25,000 and his phone may have auto-corrected the up to out of that. But independent of that.
But it can't be for the contract because the contract was breached because that's what the whole hearing's about.
Right. And if the contract hadn't
what
been
for is the question. The contract was breached though. Or at least there's an allegation that it was, and that's what you're even hiring him for.
So but from Mr. Garcia and Mr. Thompson's point of view, if that contract was never breached, that's the whole reason they were there. And the whole reason Mr. Trojan lost out on the opportunity for the completion bonus was that the contract had been breached in the first place. If it hadn't been breached, he'd be entitled to the completion bonus. So he had.
I just want to clarify though.
Okay.
The payment, the $25,000 payment to Mr. Trojan was contingent on Skyrise's success at the arbitration hearing, correct?
Right. Being made whole or perhaps proportionally whole.
Okay.
And that would give Mr. Trojan the opportunity to be made whole as well.
If we disagree with you on your vagueness argument and we disagree with you on whether or not whether or not the proof was sufficient, can you talk about what remedy you think would be appropriate here?
All right, just to make sure I have the question correct, Justice Karofsky, that if the court determines that Attorney Thompson broke the rules and that they're violated the rule and that there is no vagueness option to be had and that you will be finding misconduct. Is that the premise that we're working from?
Yes.
Okay. In that case, we posit that no more than a private reprimand is appropriate. Now, the referee has recommended a public reprimand and we disagree with that on a couple of grounds. Part of this is, again, the vagueness argument. Lawyers have been left until this point to left to their own devices to determine what is prohibited and what is permitted.
But we're gonna disagree with you on that.
We ask that you consider the vagueness as a mitigating factor to discipline, that the at the very least. But
wouldn't a public reprimand help that so that other people know for sure what?
Well, the fact is that we're here. People will know anyway. There will be a decision clarifying this rule. And that is one reason that we're here, is that there isn't a lot of guidance on this and to educate the bar.
I don't know. I always have a hard time where someone is like either thinks they should get a private reprimand or the recommendation is a private reprimand, and then they come in here because this isn't very private.
Right.
As public as it gets.
I don't disagree, but at the same time, a public reprimand is public. It's discipline. Attorneys take that very seriously. It can have reputational harm. And coming here talking about, well, maybe this is something that should be contained. I also should note that discipline is progressive. Attorney Thompson has no prior discipline. And you know, should something, I hope that I don't see you folks again here on behalf of Mr. Thompson ever again, no offense, but it is progressive. And the fact of whatever discipline, if any, flows from this, that fact will factor into any future discipline. So attorneys do have an incentive to even litigate over whether a reprimand should be public and private. In fact, I believe the US versus Nevada, or the State Bar of Nevada case, that one, was a private reprimand case that made it all the way up to the Supreme Court, the Gentile case, I'm sorry.
To what extent, just taking you back for 1 second, although I know you, I mean, maybe you want to finish answering and then I will take you back.
Okay, but I'll answer why I think a public reprimand is not appropriate, and a private reprimand, if the court finds it necessary to impose discipline. You know, there is a case in Ray Mary, I don't have the site, it's one of the earlier Mary cases, where there was a finding of a violation, but it was deemed de minimis and no discipline was imposed at all. I think there's a couple of cases like that. But if the court does find that some form of discipline is necessary, the stated goals of discipline are not supposed to be punitive. They're also not supposed to involve reputational harm, and that's what it would do. Stated goals talked about protection of the public, but also rehabilitation, deterrence. This court often considers the American Bar Association's standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, which is 9.32, mitigating factors. The mitigating factors here are, this is an isolated incident. This happened once. He has no prior discipline. This doesn't reflect a pattern. Those mitigating factors reflected together fulfill the standards criteria for an admonition, which is the standards term for a private reprimand here, absent other factors.
I know you want to ask a question.
Yeah, no, that's
I want to just follow up on a remedy question. Okay. should the amount of the inducements here, the 2 to 5,000 and the 25,000, play into our determination as to what a proper remedy is?
I think the 2,000 to the 5,000, if that speaks to the amount of time that the fair value of the time it would be, the couple of weeks that this would take to get up to speed, I don't think that should be considered at all, because I think that you wouldn't be finding a violation of the rule on that if that was found to be a reasonable compensation for that time. So let's take the $25,000 separately. This is very different from the case out of Florida, the Wall case. That involved an inducement of $100,000 to up to $1 million for somebody, again, a former employee who was going to be paid for their time. The court seemed and didn't express an opinion about the time that the court that was going to be paid for, but that inducement to testify, depending on how useful the information she provided was. That's been based on the usefulness of the information she provided. And unlike in this case, there was no logical nexus between, at least not that we could tell from the way the case was written, between that up to $1 million worth of money and anything that witness did or did not do. At least here, even if you disagree that this is appropriate, there was a connection between that $25,000 and something that Mr. Trojan did, some connection he'd had with that company. So that's where that comes from. Does that answer your question?
The question I have is, I know that sometimes rules can be vague, purposefully so, sometimes, but there can be a vagueness aspect. But one of the things we look at in determining what rules mean, well, two things we look at. One is comments, and the other is opinions. And here we have both ABA comments and SCER comments, I believe. Yes, comment three of 20:3.4b. And then we also have an ethics opinion, and all of those things talk about the fact that you can't pay witnesses any fee for testifying. You can only pay it for expenses. So to what extent does that affect your argument?
You know, again, and I think we may be talking a little bit in circles, and I apologize for that, but it does go back to the beginning that from Attorney Thompson's perspective and from the perspective of his client, they weren't paying him for the testimony. They were paying him for what he lost as a result of the what he lost as a result.
But that's not expenses. If you read these things, talk about things like the time, like you were talking about the time it takes to prepare. So how does the $25,000, like, what is that? That doesn't sound like time it is to prepare.
Well, that again goes back to the Phillips case, which I know that the referee and the OLR have taken issue with my client's interpretation of the Phillips case. But that stood for the proposition that you can't lose out on a benefit of employment if your employer terminates you to avoid paying that, which is by very rough analogy, admittedly. It gets us to where we are here, that if CatCon breached the contract, Trojan was perhaps a third party beneficiary of the contract. Again, I'm not advancing that as a legal theory, just more of as an analogy. That he should have been entitled to that money. And the only reason he lost that money, at least based on the facts that Attorney Thompson had at the time, was that he had, was that because of that breach. So that's where that gets us. I understand, and I see that my orange light is on, so I understand.
Counsel, I do have a question about your vagueness argument.
Okay.
One of the things OLR points out in response, I think, is that the void for vagueness doctrine is a First Amendment doctrine, and they posit that the discipline here is for conduct, not for speech. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a First Amendment doctrine as the, and I see my red lights on, may I continue?
Please do.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, this is conduct. We acknowledge this is conduct, but again, by analogy, lawyers should not be required to abide by a vague rule. And this shows up in criminal law, it shows up elsewhere, that if the law is too vague for somebody to know what is permitted and what is prohibited, then the tie needs to go to the runner, so to speak. And that is the last sports analogy I will make in this courtroom, but that's hopefully what gets the point across, that this is something that, going forward, it may be appropriate to say, for this court to say, all right, you can't do this at all. But that should be forward-looking and shouldn't be construed against somebody who acted prior to the clarification. My light is on, so unless anybody has any other questions, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You like sports analogies?
Mm-hmm. I don't know how to answer that.
That's okay.
But I shouldn't be the one using them.
Attorney Sullivan?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. And in terms of sports analogies, I promise I'm not trying to run the clock out here.
Well,
that's
played.
Not all I have for sports analogy.
Well played.
I'll be honest, I didn't prepare any sports analogy arguments. So I think it's instructive to start off with the text of the text that Attorney Thompson sent to Mr. Trojan. Following up on our phone conversation 3 weeks ago, Skyrise Construction has provided the following advice, stating you, should Skyrise prevail in litigation, you would be entitled to $25,000. Considering this litigation will necessitate some phone conversations with me to bring me up to speed, review of emails, you potentially sitting for a deposition hearing before the arbitrator, Skyrise will pay you $2,000 for your time in this regard. I would point out that text says nothing about reviewing large boxes of documents. It says nothing about assisting in preparing for the hearing. It relates only to phone conversations, review of emails, and a potential deposition hearing. I'm going to make four arguments. I will make them as briefly as I can. First argument is that 3.4b is not void for vagueness. Second is that the court should adopt the referee's recommendation that a public reprimand is appropriate for this conduct. If this is an issue, and I'm not sure it still is, but I will address any questions the court has about whether this conduct was prohibited by law. I think it's clear that it was, but if there are questions in that regard, I'm happy to take them. And then I would finish with the fact that the referee found that the employment contract terminated in 2018 and that the project was not completed on time or within budget. And therefore, Trojan was not entitled to the bonus, whether or not they prevailed in the arbitration. So addressing vagueness first, this court has held as far back as the Seraphim case that professional standards of conduct are necessarily broad, particularly with respect to legal practice. There's a lot of different kinds of lawyers, a lot of different kinds of legal practice, and the standards are deliberately broad to accommodate those. Seraphim was the case where this court held that the misconduct rule doesn't have to establish precise standards of behavior. And I think the line that's really instructive here is that the reading of the rule is not as a layman, but as a judge with 20 years experience and an attorney of almost 20 more. This rule provided fair notice of the prohibited conduct. You cannot offer a witness an inducement that is prohibited by law. Turning to the referee's recommendation on sanction, the referee recommended a public reprimand. OLR agrees with that recommendation. And here's the analysis behind it. The attorney has a duty to act with integrity to legal process. That flows throughout the rules, certainly through 20:3. But particularly in this rule, why don't you offer a witness an inducement that's prohibited by law? Because it messes with the integrity of the process, because it incentivizes a witness to shade their testimony, to say things they wouldn't otherwise say, to either earn the prohibited compensation or, you know, I'll just leave it there. The duty is serious. The mental state is another factor that is that the ABA standards consider. The referee made no finding with respect to Attorney Thompson's mental state, but he did determine that his conduct in offering the $25,000 bonus was most inappropriate. Attorney Thompson should have known that he was in an ethically complex situation. He should have done ethics research, and he should have done independent research on the calculations that Mr. Garcia provided him, that Mr. Garcia relied on to get to those $2,000 and $5,000 figures. The testimony in the record from Attorney Thompson is he's not sure if he did that research at the time or when the issue was raised during the arbitration.
I want to ask you something about the $2,000 to $5,000. Your friend on the other side says that that is reasonable compensation. Can you respond to that?
When Trojan was working for Skyrise, he was making $50,000 a year. $5,000 is 200 hours of his time. Even if you accept the version where Mr. Garcia determines that his time is not worth $50,000 a year, but $90,000 a year, you're still looking at something more than 100 hours of time for those $5,000, or something more than 40 hours of time for those $2,000. And when you compare that to the scope of work that Attorney Thompson described in the text, it doesn't add up. Returning briefly to sanction, the potential harm that occurred here is corrupting the arbitration process. The aggravating factor that the referee identified is that Attorney Thompson still does not recognize that this behavior is misconduct. Mitigating factors, as my colleague identified, he has cooperated with the OLR proceeding throughout. He has a long history of practice in this state with no prior discipline. The referee found, and we conclude that that equates to a public reprimand, which also meets that goal of deterrence. I am not comfortable with the argument that the amount of discipline should vary significantly based on the amount of inducement. We think that an unlawful inducement is an unlawful inducement, and you should not induce witnesses to testify using unlawful means.
So why isn't it a private reprimand as opposed to a public reprimand?
Because private reprimand better suits it comes closer to the discipline that this court has imposed, because this is behavior that should be public, that the discipline should be public, both for Attorney Thompson in particular and general. And a public reprimand has much more of a deterrent effect than a private reprimand. As my colleague pointed out, it is significant to have your name attached to public discipline for offering an unlawful inducement to a witness. And we believe that has significantly more deterrent value than a private reprimand. I think it's clear that the inducements were prohibited by law. Attorney Thompson knew that Trojan was going to be an important witness in the arbitration. And he did. There is, as my colleague pointed out, testimony that from Attorney Thompson that says, I did think that might have helped him, incentivized him to help participate in putting this thing together. It's clear that this was an incentive. It's clear that this was an unlawful incentive. The common law rule, as the comment notes, is you cannot offer witnesses any inducements to testify. Fact witnesses. Fact witnesses are subpoenaed and they testify because it's their legal duty under a subpoena to testify. In Wisconsin, we've modified that. We have a statute that allows the princely sum of $5 a day to appear as a witness at an arbitration and 20 cents a mile. We have adopted a practice that allows fact witnesses to be reasonably compensated for their time. That is not what's happening here. Garcia, in fact, testified that Mr. Trojan would, and I quote, have to take maybe a couple days off to work or work on this review after hours. That does not match up to the amount of money that Mr. Trojan was offered, never mind the contingent inducement. And finally, there is substantial support in the record for the finding that the employment contract was terminated the day after Skyrise's contract was terminated. Testimony in the record is that Garcia told Trojan on August 14th, he would have to take a pay cut. Trojan refused to take a pay cut. He was asked to leave. Testimony is that he left, that he handed in his car keys to the company car, and that after that date, he didn't get paid. And Garcia refers to him throughout the proceeding as a former employee of Skyrise. Furthermore, he was never going to be entitled to that bonus anyway, because the project was not completed within schedule. It was not completed within budget. And the compensation clause says the bonus is paid per each project signed. And there's no testimony in the record that Trojan signed this project. Unless the court has any questions, I will stop talking and sit down.
Anyone have any questions? I don't see any. Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you, and I'll endeavor to be brief, and I know that my red light will make me be brief. So first of all, when my friend on the other side points to the text message that Attorney Thompson sent to Mr. Trojan, what we're forgetting here is that that is just a text message. It's a couple hundred characters explaining the gist of what Mr. Thompson wanted to talk to him about. It was not a contract for services. It was not the full scope of what was going to be discussed. The fact is that there was and there may not have been specifics about what specific documents, what needed to be reviewed, that there was a giant dolly of stuff that needed to be reviewed. The fact is that the offer was later raised to $5,000, and that was communicated somewhere. We don't have the message that suggests that, but there would have been more specifics. So we can't rely on the text message at all by itself to determine the scope of the project. And also, I believe it was Mr. Garcia's testimony, and certainly Mr. Thompson's, that this would be an endeavor. He may have to take a couple of days off of work, but it was going to be a project of 80, 90 hours, somewhere in that vicinity. How that got happened, whether that happened in the evening or on weekends, or whether he was working or not, the ethics opinions do say that you can be compensated, witnesses can be compensated for the fair value of their time, whether that's a time they would be working and they had to miss, or it's just time that they would rather be spending doing something else.
And what's your explanation for the going from 2,000 to 5,000 within a matter of like a month?
There was testimony that was based on further study and further examining that this would be a much bigger undertaking than expected. So it's just a simple, it's math. I think it's also important to point out that this offer was never responded to. It was never accepted. There was no money tendered. And I think that does need to factor in, at least as mitigation. Attorney Thompson has...
Why is that mitigation? Someone else say something? No. Okay, I'm not...
Just you. You're
now I'm not starting to hear things. why is that mitigating if it's what someone else did and not what your client did?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat the... I didn't quite hear the last few.
Sorry.
Okay.
I'm hearing you saying it's a mitigating factor that the offer was never accepted, and I'm confused by that because that seems to be out of the control of your client.
Well, one of the factors, factors looked at is whether there was potential harm or actual harm. There was no documented actual harm here, if we need to go into that direction. Nobody was paid for their testimony. If the court wants to take a look at that, because the OLR has indicated this is corrupting the arbitration process, but we didn't get that far. So Mr. Thompson has indicated in the case below in a briefing, he is, in order to educate the bar, willing to write for the Wisconsin lawyer on this, and perhaps that.
Counsel, I have a concern about that down here. I have a concern about that because it seems to me that what Mr. Thompson is saying is that he wishes to be privately reprimanded and then hold himself out as an expert on this rule to the rest of the bar. And that seems entirely inappropriate to me.
He's determined that this is going to be an educational experience, however this turns out. And this is not determinative as to how this case turns out or what this court says. Because he does want this to be a learning experience. He does want the bar to know what he didn't at the time. And to know with clarity what is expected of them, what is required, and what is forbidden.
And that seems consistent likewise with the purposes of a public reprimand.
And again, that takes us back then to the public the purpose of a public reprimand isn't to be punitive. It can be educational, but so can other means. And the fact of the matter is lawyers do take public reprimands, having their name attached to this in a disciplinary context is serious. And, regardless, I know this is kind of an all stick, no carrot system where somebody fighting for a private reprimand or even somebody objecting to a private reprimand and trying to have no discipline has to get up in a public forum, at least in briefing, to appeal, if not arguing before the seven justices here. But it's the system we have. If unless anybody has any other questions, I will also sit down and thank you again for your time.
I don't see any questions. Thanks to both of you for answering our questions. We are adjourned.